I'm Josie Mitchell, and this is the Granta Magazine podcast. In this new season, we speak to authors about their novels, memoirs, story collections, and poetry. Thanks, as ever, to the authors who agreed to join me from all over the world this year. Today we're talking to Eula Biss. Eula is a celebrated writer of nonfiction books that look at large, intractable questions about who holds power in our society and why. In 2009, she published Notes from No Man's Land, an exploration of race from the perspective of a white citizen in American society. On Immunity, which came out in 2015, examines the fear of government and the medical establishment that underlies the reluctance to get vaccinated. Both books have proved remarkably prescient in identifying tensions underlying American society and societies around the world. Eula's new book, Having and Being Had, reckons with the author's own success and interrogates her perceived admission or readmission to the middle classes as an adult. You can read an excerpt from the book on Granta.com. Check out the link below. So, Eula, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Where are you based at the moment in the world?
I'm just outside Chicago. I'm in my house. I'm up in the attic where I write. It's a little cold up here right now.
I mean, it's been one of the aspects of talking to writers this year and last year is sort of you're talking from bedrooms and spare rooms and sheds. Yes. It's been really different.
Yes, yes. Yeah, I'm writing from the attic that I share as a workspace with my partner. But under these new circumstances where everyone's working from home and learning from home, it's starting to feel a little crowded in our attic.
Yeah, I think that we're under quite strict limitations here. We can't really leave the house other than to go to the grocery store or to buy, I don't know, to get your exercise. Are you under any rules?
Yes, most everything is still closed. It's a little less strict for us, and we can go out for reasons other than exercising groceries, but there's not much else that's available. It's either closed or it's strongly advised against.
What are your coping strategies? I know some people do like workouts at home. I really miss the pool. What are you up to?
I'm at the pool too. I've been doing something that seemed crazy to me at first. I have an artist friend who I was swimming in the lake with over the summer. We were swimming in Lake Michigan, and as the weather cooled, we didn't want to give it up. So we started swimming in wetsuits, and we kept going. Now I'm still going every week, and I think the water was 34 the last time I swam, 34 Fahrenheit. So
I'm trying to imagine that in Celsius. I'm sure it's freezing.
Just above freezing. It's like a degree above freezing.
Yeah. It's supposed to be very good for the mind, though, isn't it? Hydrotherapy. It keeps you sharp.
Yeah. And, you know, I've read that this is something of like established activity in England.
It's a huge thing. Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. It's a little rarer here, but it's actually been quite a thrill. And even just to be like outside in a moment that feels wild is refreshing. But it also feels crazy. It feels crazy to get into the water when it's,
I mean, I'm really impressed. I've had a dabble in that culture because it is very much a culture, but I don't think I could get below 15 degrees Celsius, which is probably not really even that bad. I don't know, but it's
there's something strange that happens though below a certain temperature. So even 30 degrees warmer than what I'm swimming in and was still felt agonizingly cold to me. And then below a certain temperature, the water numbs your body instantly, so it's a different sensation.
Next year. So many things will happen next year, as we're all saying to one another. I know also that you teach, or I read that you in your book that you teach.
Yes.
Has that been affected this year? Are you Zooming?
Yes, I am Zooming all my teaching. I teach undergraduates and graduate students here, and I started doing that in the spring, in March, when my university shut down. And I'm used to it now, and I think the students are too. At first, I found it torturous. I really disliked it, and it was very exhausting for me too. But I've adjusted. Yeah. And I'm very happy and grateful to see my students these days. You know, they're one of my primary forms of social contact. I see my family and my students, and that's it.
I know what you mean. We're gonna talk about your book, Having and Being Had, in a little bit. And I thought what we could start with is a reading from the book. And I know you had a passage that you thought you could read. I'd love to hear it.
Great. This is from early in the book, and it's the title of this passage is Pokemon. Jay has two Pokemon cards that he was given on the first day of first grade by a boy who told him they were starter cards. He doesn't know anything about Pokemon, but soon he wants more cards. At the comic book shop, we discover that a pack of these cards costs $3, which means Jay can buy them with the money I give him for doing chores. But what the cards cost has nothing to do with what they're worth. The value of any given card is determined by a group of children gathered on the asphalt of the school playground. There is, in the world beyond the playground, an established market for these cards and websites that chart their rising and falling prices like stocks. But these kids don't really know about that yet. They're still inventing their own values. On the asphalt, some cards are coveted because they're shiny, others because nobody has them yet, and others because they're powerful. How powerful a card might be is defined from the numbers printed on the card, which are manipulated with flawed first grade math that leads to debate over the exact quantity of power in play. There's debate too about what constitutes a good trade. After Jay trades away his most powerful card for a less powerful card, I hear the babysitter asking him if he was a smart negotiator. She suggests that he might want to try to get more for a card like that next time. Then he comes home with the entire collection of another boy, 2 years younger, who's traded it all to him for one card. A game can be played with these cards, supposedly, but none of the kids understand the rules. Their end is accumulation, collecting cards for a game they don't know how to play.
Thank you. I love that you chose that passage, actually, because I think it's a really lovely way in to what we're talking about. It's a great stand-in, I guess, for these questions about value and money. But I wondered, what this metaphor or what this analogy offered you, these Pokemon cards, it must have been really fascinating witnessing your child playing with them and negotiating.
Yeah, I watched this unfold for years. This moment is just about the very beginning of a Pokemon obsession that lasted for quite a long time. But I felt, as I watched it, I felt like I was seeing an economy being born. It was this amazing, for me, microcosm of larger systems of value and invented value. These children were inventing a value system together. And in many ways, the value system was arbitrary, or it looked arbitrary to me as someone who didn't value any Pokemon cards. Their system of value seemed totally arbitrary. And so for me, it seemed like a very apt and ready metaphor for our larger economy. And throughout this book, I was asking little mundane moments like this to stand in as metaphors for broader, more abstract, more difficult to see or grasp concepts. Moments in my own life where I could see the logic of our economy at work. And the part in this moment that was somewhat heartbreaking to me was watching my young child learn the logic of capitalism. Part of that logic is get as much as you can for as little as possible. There's that moment where he gives the card away, and it's an act of generosity, but he's immediately taught that he shouldn't do something like that.
Yeah, I find that moment, it's so telling, isn't it? Immediately he's prompted to think about how he should be using the cards to trade them in a way that he gets as many as he can and give up as little, and then becomes really successful quite quickly. You know, he comes home and he has this other less canny child's entire collection. But yeah, I thought what we could sort of talk about in beginning to introduce the book is the sort of events that came to prompt you starting to think about these ideas, which I think in the notes of the book you identify as having bought a house. And I guess leading up to that as well, it would be getting a secure job with a decent wage and a retirement plan. I got the sense that this wasn't the expected route. Some people automatically expect all of these things. Would that be fair?
Oh, yeah. It was all of this was a surprise, in part because I was raised by an artist. My mother's an artist who never had any money and never made any money really to speak of from her work as an artist. And I was raised with the understanding that what it meant to be an artist was that you would not be able to live like other people. You wouldn't be able to have a secure livelihood. You wouldn't be able to own the things that other people have. You wouldn't be able to have a secure retirement, things like that. So I very much, when I made the decision to be a writer and to dedicate my time to this pursuit, in my understanding, I was giving up things like the security of retirement and things like owning a home. In my mind, it's very much a conversation with my mother about money and security and time. It's not written that way. I don't directly address her, and she only makes the briefest appearances, but it came out of a conversation I was having in my mind with her. And the conditions of my life at that time were that I had this new house, newly secure job. But I was also working too much for me. I was working so much that I was getting migraines for the first time in my life. And I had absolutely no time for writing. I was teaching, I was parenting, but I was also traveling to promote the book that I had just written. And so part of my week was dedicated to teaching. And then I would get on a flight and go somewhere and do my work as a writer and then return and try to spend some time with my child and then start it all over. And I knew it wasn't sustainable, that kind of rhythm of work. It wasn't sustainable for my health and well-being, but I also couldn't write under those conditions.
I like the way you put that because it really brings forth for me the sense that these two key ideas in the book seem to be time and money. You're thinking about scarcity with both of those two things.
Yeah. And I think it's very common for people of my class, so upper middle class, to feel an extreme scarcity of time and but to also tolerate that and to accept that and to on some level believe that that's, you know, that's the trade they've made, that they give up their time in exchange for the comforts of a upper middle class life and the securities, right? It's not just about comfort and luxury. I think, especially in the US, there's some basic securities that people don't really have until they get to the higher end of the middle class. So a retirement account and the ability to send a child to college and even healthcare, high quality healthcare. All of these things are things that are not provided by the state. So it takes quite a bit of money to cover all of those things.
I think that dilemma felt like a really fertile one in the book. You know, so on the one hand, I think you seem to pose the question that perhaps money can be corrupting, that getting lots of money might even be immoral, and there's this deep sensitivity to accruing it. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, society is getting less and less safe. The welfare state is falling apart. Mm-hmm. Having money is so important when it comes to feeling safe.
Yes.
That felt like a moral dilemma you were grappling with. Where do you stand with it? Do you think that's shifted?
It's an ongoing dilemma for me because I think This comes back again to this kind of secret conversation I was having with my mother. I saw what living close to poverty did to my mother's life and did to her ability to make her art. And I saw the kind of constant disruption that is caused by not having enough money, where something like a car breaking down becomes a major crisis, not a minor crisis. Or being sick is a major crisis. Lots of little things are major crises.
Yes.
When you don't have enough money and you don't have backup accounts or something to draw from, when you're living really paycheck to paycheck. And I think I've been clear for a really long time that I don't want to live like that. And some artists choose that life, and my mother did. And they choose that life for the kind of freedom of decision it leaves them in their art making. But I saw how it closed off other freedoms for my mother, and ultimately resulted in her spending less time on her art rather than more, because she was forced to take a job with long hours just to cover her basic needs. So, and this is past her retirement age, right? I think I've been clear since I was actually quite young, since I was in my 20s, that I didn't want to live that close to the bone.
That's such a good image. That's a good phrase, yeah.
And I knew that it would be disruptive to my creative work, because I'd seen that at close hand. I'd seen that kind of disruption. But at the same time, I don't feel comfortable with the system that produces wealth for some people and not others. And I don't feel comfortable, for instance, in the system that we have for saving for retirement, which is, it happens in the stock market. And I'm aware of all the some of them are quite invisible ways that my security is based on other people's insecurity. I find it quite a knot.
Yeah.
And I think of this book as a series of knots that I was kind of teasing at, pulling at the threads a little bit to see if I could loosen the knot a little. I know I could choose to have less money tomorrow. And that's part of what I was trying to write about in this book. It's more that I feel trapped within the system in which the money and the wealth and the security are generated and very unevenly distributed.
Absolutely. It feels frustrating.
It is. And I think our society is rich enough in this country and in yours to put far fewer people in that position. I think we could distribute the wealth differently so that if, say, healthcare, retirement, and higher education were all provided for, maybe also housing as it is in some countries, then some people could make very little of earned income and not have to put themselves in precarious positions and sometimes even in danger when it comes to, your ability to treat serious health problems or something like that.
Fundamentally, it's about safety.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's about safety and basic security. And that's just one of the violences of our economic system is that is denied so many people. And one of the tricky things about writing this book is I was writing a critique of that system as someone who had not been denied that safety and security. It felt to me, especially in that moment in my life where the pivot happened, where I got the house and I had the retirement account. And when I sold this book, I was able to start a college savings account for my son. And with all of these new forms of security, it felt to me like it was my responsibility to critique the system that I was profiting from, essentially. And I do kind of think in this book, there are various critiques of capitalism. Mm. Many of them are made with a wink or a joke or a wry laugh, because I understand that I'm on the winning end of capitalism. It's, if we think of it as a game. And so it's, I also understand that for a reader, I'm in an odd position to make a critique from. So that was one of the problems of writing the book, was to work with that.
You know, I think that's true. And it also seems to be a subject position that you're quite drawn to. You know, there's, yeah, people talk about this idea of complicity in systems. And this is reminding me of Notes from No Man's Land, which is positioned in a not dissimilar way, in the sense that you're critiquing a racial caste system in America from the position of being a white person. So it's that same thing. You're saying, I'm going to critique a system from which I benefit.
Yeah.
It must be quite a challenging thing to execute. How do you go about it? What practice do you bring to that?
I think you're right in that I did learn much of my approach in writing about race and writing about race as a white person. And I think that primed me to be able to approach it, writing about money and economics, maybe in part because in writing about race, I was clear that I had been damaged by the system that was damaging to other people as well. So even though there's all kinds of material gains for white people within racist societies and structures and systems, quite a bit of damage is done as well too. And it may be the damage that's most meaningful to me is, I think, as in most systems of power, the people on the top are made stupid and the people on the bottom are made resentful. And the more I wrote about race, the more aware I was of the ways in which I'd been made stupid by the system and blind. And and as someone who values knowledge, that was really, you know, I don't even know the word for it. It's kind of crushing to know that you've been systematically made stupid, you know, and from not just my own education, but from my position in society, from the things that I don't have to think about. And so I don't think about. And I think when I wrote about that, I did feel very personal and private dismay over my own naivete, stupidity, ignorance. But I also wrote from an understanding that was the product of the culture and the system that I had grown up within. So I didn't really treat it like a private personal failing so much as the inevitable outcome of a system of oppression. And I think I brought that understanding into writing about money, in that I understand myself as being part of a culture, right? And so I think in this book, I'm making a cultural critique. I'm making it through myself. But I don't actually believe myself as an individual to be any better or any worse than any other player in this system. I understand that my position, even a good number of my values, many of my actions, what I know and don't know, what I do and don't understand, have all been shaped by my economic position. So, I think that makes it possible for me to write the book. You know, it's not really a self-critique, though. I think some people read it that way, but I intend it as a cultural critique. I, you know, to the extent that I am representative of an upper middle class culture, mindset, way of life, or at least vulnerable to some of those things, you know, I'm writing into that.
You're doing a cultural critique. And you're using yourself as a case study, in a way, as somebody who knows yourself well.
Yes.
You say, exhibit A, i.e. me, you know, and these are my experiences. Yes. which I think takes a certain courage, because as you say, it can be read as a self-critique and people might assume that you're talking individually rather than generally.
Mm-hmm.
I don't doubt that that required a lot of work, personal work.
It did. It required quite a bit of self-reflection and self-interrogation. And many times I bumped up against, beliefs that I had about myself or my life or my lifestyle or my economics that on examination weren't true. So that kept happening again and again, where I kept realizing, oh, I thought one way about myself or my position in society. And now that I've put it under scrutiny, it's just not true. And I think like many people, I didn't actually really have an understanding of my class position in relationship to other people. It's, and I know now after doing some of the research that supported this book that it's, that's not uncommon, and partly because our class categories are so fuzzy and vague. Not even the people who study them really know where these categories begin and end. But, once I started writing about it and asking myself, okay, where am I economically in position to other people? And I started looking at numbers and looking at the census and looking where the median income is in the US. I was a little shocked, I have to say. And again, this like betrays some naivete. But I had much more than I thought I had in relationship to other people. And I think many people, no matter where they are on the class spectrum, think of themselves as typical, ordinary, normal in some way. And it was very clear to me from looking at the numbers that my position was not typical in this country, not ordinary, and that most people did not have as much as I had.
It's a process that I think threads through the book and I find really interesting. I think there's a moment where you say, I had thought that I had been a member of the precariat and that I'd then become middle class as my income changed. But when I thought about it, I wondered perhaps whether I had always been middle class. Maybe that's an example of this sort of these assumptions one has about oneself that one has to challenge. I find that really interesting one, you know, that sort of somebody who's perhaps made decisions, even if they haven't felt necessarily as to earn a certain income that puts them in the slot that they might say, oh, well, I only earn this amount, you know, so I'm a member of the precariat. It might be more complicated than that.
Yes, for sure. I think it's so much more complicated. And there is a temptation sometimes to only think about class in terms of income, which the more I thought about this and the more I read, the more I realized that that's just one dimension of class and it's not the most telling sometimes. So yes, I went through a fairly long period of my life where I had very little money. When I lived in New York 15, 20 years ago, I lived off $8,000 a year. It was a very minimal existence. But that doesn't erase the fact that I was educated at a private university and that I carried with me through that time period many of the privileges of being white and being born into a middle-class family. And I didn't have health insurance, but I had access to certain kinds of employment that other people wouldn't. And I had, and I also had expectations. You know, this is something that's very interesting to me. In conversation with my partner who comes from a lower class background, his father worked in a factory on the south side of Chicago. And my father was a physician. I've discovered in conversation with him that he doesn't expect his work to be rewarding, personally satisfying. He expects his work to earn him money, and that's what it's there for. And, you know, I want that and more. And I think that that's a class expectation, actually. Like, I want my work to earn me money and I want it to be gratifying, and I want to be treated well by the people I work with, and I want all these things that I think, because of my background, I've been led to believe that I can and should expect from a workplace.
I think that's well laid out. So to zoom out, to sort of look at this process that you are engaging in, which I find very valuable, is sort of holding up of oneself, accounting, trying to challenge assumptions about maybe where you stand in society, interrogate your position. I don't mean this as a challenge. I mean it as an actual question. Do you think that is enough? Do you think that is doing enough?
I think it's a beginning. I don't think it's enough if the process stops there. But for me, doing this self-interrogation had a lot of ramifications for action in my life. It changed from things like, it changed the amount of money I give away. When I give money, I give more now because I have a better sense of how much I have. But it also changed how I live and how much I earn. In writing this book kind of freed me psychologically to step away from the job that I was doing while I was writing it. And so I'm now part-time at the same job, but that involved taking a fairly huge pay cut. And it also involved removing myself from an avenue for promotion, right? So I can't, from the position that I went down to, now that I'm part-time, I can't rise through the ranks in my workplace. I've just got to be where I am. But writing this book enabled me to make that trade. It helped clarify for me that what I wanted was time, not money or promotions. And so it allowed me to make this decision that I think by some other metric would look unwise or like unambitious or something. But for me, it was actually, it became clear that I was fulfilling my ambitions by doing this. But I do think, you know, this book has also clarified for me writing it what policies I think really need to change, economic policies. It's clarified kind of what I would want out of changes to our economic system. I'm clearer on what I think is most important and why. It changed my sense of what a universal basic income would do and what it could be and things like that. So I do think that this process can lead to change, not just in people's lives, but in the system itself. But it is in itself not that change, right? It is what it is.
It's part of the process one would hope.
Yes. You know? One comparison in my mind is this this wonderful article Ta-Nehisi Coates wrote years ago. I think it was in The Atlantic, called The Case for Reparations. And he was taking very seriously a topic that at the time was not being talked about seriously by politicians, which was this idea of paying reparations to African Americans who have been damaged financially by centuries and centuries of policies and practices that are exclusionary and racist. And that piece made arguments, but it also invited reflection on the injustice of the system and how that injustice might be addressed. And that was years ago. And now the town that I live in is, I think we're the only municipality in the United States that has enacted reparations. So this town has started the process and has already funded it. Actually, the fund has money in it. They're still at the point in the process where they're figuring out how they're going to disperse reparations to people. Super tricky, you know? So it's like it's an unfolding process and it's full of problems and sticky points. But in my mind, it's Ta-Nehisi Coates, his careful thinking about this issue laid the groundwork for somebody to actually do it and carry it out.
That is very satisfying to hear.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll see how it unfolds, but it's a start.
It's interesting what you just said, because I think several times in your book, you do talk about revolution, and I think pull back from it several times in a way that I think you've sort of explained your alternative. I was going to ask, you know, if not revolution, if you have this desire for change, what does that look like? And I think that Ta-Nehisi Coates example is a really excellent example of incremental policy-based change.
Yeah.
That said, I'm struck, I'm, you know, sort of looking at your books, looking at, you know, you've written a book on the sort of racial caste system in America. You've also written a book about vaccinations, about fear of government and the medical establishment. I thought, you know, looking at the pattern here, it seems like there'll probably be an anti-capitalist revolution in the next few years based on what Ulibis has written about.
I can only dream. I hope so. though, I mean, what I hope for, I do have, I think, an increasingly like middle-aged hope. I really don't want a bloody revolution, and I'm very aware of that. And I have been for a while, you know, I'm drawn to Marxist historians and various kinds of Marxist thinking, but I've actually never been able to get excited about the idea of a bloody revolution that will, even if it results in a much better world. I've always paused there and thought, but there's got to be some better way. There's got to be a better way for us to do this. And you know, one of the exciting things about doing the research that I did for this book was seeing how the economy we have today was made, and how it's the process, it's the product of a lot of small decisions. And actually in this country, and I think this is true in Britain too, the shape of our economy and how it acts and what it does for people changed radically between World War II and now, and even between 1970 and now. When you look back historically, you can see, okay, decisions were made that shifted the shape of this. And we actually don't need to do it with a war. I mean, you know, my earlier self, my younger self, I think was very drawn to the idea of burn it down, start from the ground. You know, I think that was my attitude. But, you know, living in a country where just recently I saw, you know, our Capitol building broken into, and with this idea of burn it down, destroy it, like undo this democracy, I think I'm newly aware of how damaging and, you know, potentially destructive that attitude is. And so I think my middle-aged attitude is, let's not burn it down. Let's fundamentally change it.
You've been listening to the Granta Magazine podcast. Please do subscribe if you'd like to hear more of these episodes, and give us a rating if you enjoyed this one. And if you're keen to find more great writing, check out granta.com.